We'll take up Gomez v. Torrance.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Conrad Herring, representing the appellants and the plaintiffs. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, and I have to say I'm looking forward to eating and sleeping normally again. I don't know what these cases do, but I'd rather be nervous than not care about them. This is a wrongful death case, as the Court is aware. The complaint was filed after the statute of limitations expired. Excuse me. This is a statute of limitations issue.
What date did the statute of limitations expire?
It would have been August 19th, 2006.
But for your claim of equitable estoppel?
We're claiming equitable estoppel. I think there's some confusion in the district court and on all the way up into the appeal as to what that means. I'd like to start first with what I think we all agree on factually and as to the law, because we agreed that the plaintiff's son was shot and killed by a Torrance police officer, and we know they were informed of that event the next morning. Under federal law, I agree with appellees that that gave them the requisite knowledge to know that they had a potential claim for a wrongful death. That means that they didn't necessarily have a viable claim, but they were on notice that they had, at that point, a limited period of time to bring their lawsuit, to contemplate bringing the lawsuit, to investigate. And actually, during that time, they filed a wrongful death claim with the city of Torrance, further evidencing that they know that there's a potential claim there. The statute of limitations does expire. That's undisputed. And the lawsuit is filed almost 6 months after the statute of limitations expires. There's an intervening event that takes place from the time the statute expires until it causes the plaintiffs to reconsider and actually file this lawsuit. Those are the fraudulent concealment allegations that the plaintiffs allege. The Torrance Police Department covered up what really happened. They withheld evidence, they concealed some evidence, they actually changed some evidence. And what they did, based on our allegations, is recreate the scene to justify the shooting. We pled everything we knew at the time when we filed a complaint. During discovery, we learned additional allegations, and we proffered those to the district court in response to the summary judgment motion. Those include, I think, more serious allegations than we were aware of when we filed a complaint. Those include the withholding of a material police eyewitness statement that goes to the heart of the liability, whether or not the defendant or the suspect was armed, whether or not there was a deadly situation inside the restaurant. But it goes to the concealment issues as well. We asked the court for leave to conduct additional discovery based on the new allegations that we learned in discovery.
That was both you received a copy of the full original police report and a copy of the surveillance tape?
In discovery.
In discovery.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. We also obtained those before filing the lawsuit, but after the statute of limitations expired. And the allegations of the concealment deal with the surveillance video being extremely inconsistent with what's in the police reports. Dealing with the appellee's summary judgment motion, it's brought on very limited legal grounds. The facts are undisputed based on their motion. They're simply saying what I've already recited. And they're saying that our allegations are post-accrual. And because they're post-accrual, they're irrelevant to the summary judgment issue. The brief filed by appellees, it's a brief dealing with the discovery rule, not equitable estoppel. Because equitable estoppel actually presumes that the cause of action has accrued. And during the statutory period, from accrual to expiration, the allegations for estoppel require the plaintiff to allege that there's some concealment that causes them to forego filing the lawsuit. When appellees say that those allegations are irrelevant, they're misunderstanding that tolling issue, and they're focused solely on the issue of the discovery rule. So they didn't brief it, they didn't challenge our allegations, and they said they were irrelevant. What the district court went and did was look at the allegations and then say, that they weren't sufficiently pled. We disagree with that, but we asked the district court for leave to amend, and the district court denied that.
It's kind of an odd procedural posture when the motion is for summary judgment and we're discussing the allegations in the complaint. You have the you had evidentiary facts, right?
Correct. There was we did produce evidence in support of the allegations, but their motion deems the allegations irrelevant. In other words, we could prove them conclusively, but according to their motion, it doesn't matter because the allegations of concealment are post-accrual. They missed the issue on equitable estoppel because equitable estoppel requires the cause of action to accrue. That's the legal issue.
Did the district court rule that the pleading was insufficient, or did the district court rule that you didn't come up with a sufficient showing in opposition to the summary judgment motion?
Your Honor, I am not completely clear what the district court was doing. It did state, and it's in its conclusion when it's ruling on, it says the plaintiffs did not plead with sufficient particularity.
And didn't he also say it didn't come forward with sufficient evidence?
The court does say that there's no evidence. But if you read the court's ruling along with the hearing testimony, what the judge is asking for in the hearing, the judge is asking for proof within the complaint itself. That's the way I interpret what the court has done. To the extent that the court is saying, well, you didn't come up with sufficient evidence to respond to the summary judgment motion, I make three points. One, appellees say it's irrelevant, so if we were to prove them conclusively, it doesn't address the legal issue that they put before the court. So they haven't properly raised the issue of whether the concealment allegations are proved. Secondly, we do have evidence in the
record. You don't have to prove them on summary judgment. You just have to show there's a genuine issue of material fact if it's summary judgment. But the district court somehow confused or conflated the two standards between what the complaint had to allege and what you had to show to support the complaint. But that's not the standard we should be looking at this stage.
I agree. I'm not sure where the court was headed when it did what it did, but it's ruling. It's granting summary judgment, but it can't grant the summary judgment brought by appellees because theirs is a very narrow legal argument. They're saying we're barred by the discovery rule, and I agree with that.
Well, did you file an opposition to the motion for summary judgment?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
And what did that consist of?
That consisted of, well, our legal arguments. We also raised evidentiary issues. We provided evidence.
You provided the evidence that's alleged in the complaint.
We did. And we asserted that there's video surveillance that supports our allegations in part. There's also my declaration. There are still frame photographs that actually show the shooting scene itself and support our allegations. But also, I want to get back to the point of our request to conduct additional discovery, because what we learned in discovery further supports the fraudulent concealment.
So you made a motion under 56F?
That is correct, Your Honor.
After the motion for summary judgment had been filed?
In our response.
Okay.
In our response, and also, I believe, at the hearing. At the hearing, when the court was questioning the sufficiency of the allegations, we did ask for leave to amend at that time. But the court didn't rule on that. The court seemed to be saying, if you read the opinion, that failure to adequately plead weighs the defense. And that's not correct, because the court has to at least exercise its discretion and consider whether amendment would be futile. And the appellees say it wouldn't.
Well, at this point, you don't really, I mean, at this point, you should be going by the pretrial conference schedule or the scheduling order. I mean, at some point, those orders would supersede the complaint. I mean, you've had discovery. You're on summary judgment. I don't know why
we're... Well, the summary judgment... Yes, Your Honor. We began discovery in earnest in April, and we requested the eyewitness statements and the surveillance video. We received those in June. Discovery cutoff was not till November 12th. They filed their motion in July, and Local Rule 7.3 requires them to tell us where we can then discuss these issues. I would submit that if we had discussed them, they would have said the evidence of the fraudulent concealment allegations aren't relevant because, their argument is they post-date the accrual, so they have no application. We're asking this court to reverse the summary judgment, remand, either to give us the opportunity to file a first amended complaint or to proceed on the original complaint. We believe it's sufficiently pled, and we did include evidence to support those allegations, even though the allegations aren't the subject of their motion and they're not challenged. The court has any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Bob Dado for the appellee, City of Torrance, and David Maitland. I want to go straight to address some of the court's concerns and their questions. I don't know if they're concerns. They're questions. There was a question, I believe, Judge Wardlaw, what did the plaintiffs have and when did they have it? The plaintiffs had the police investigation report early on. It was the period they got it shortly after.
It was the redacted police investigation.
Yeah,
it was the one that omitted the fact that there was a discrepancy between the two officers as to the story.
I don't believe that was the redaction, Your Honor. I believe the redaction was simply the names were redacted. I believe that's what the record shows. The names were redacted. But not information. My understanding of what plaintiff's allegations are is that the police report was somehow inaccurate or incomplete. But I don't believe it was a situation where there was a paragraph that was lined out, for example. I don't think there's any evidence in the record that would suggest that. But it's interesting about the report. And the report, as I said, the plaintiffs get early on. And I missed this fact when I did the appellee's brief, so I'm not trying to sandbag anybody. It was one little line in the record, but it's an important line that this court should know. The police investigative report references the surveillance video. How do we know that? We know that from the declaration of Mr. Herring in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, where he says that he's attempting to authenticate the pictures that come from the video, and he says it's authenticated on the basis of the investigative report. And this is on page 54, the excerpts of record, lines 6 and 7. So we know that the investigative report, the one that the plaintiffs get early on, references the surveillance video. Now, if I'm a defendant and I'm trying to fraudulently conceal something to prevent a plaintiff from filing a lawsuit, the last thing I do is give them a report that says, hey, there's a video. There's a video here. There is no evidence of fraudulent concealment in this case. That's the point that I want to bring home here. If plaintiff's theory of fraudulent concealment or equitable estoppel is correct, then any time you have an allegation that there is an inaccurate statement in a police report concerning police conduct, it tolls the statute of limitations. I am not aware of any case that's gone that far, and it doesn't make any sense that it does.
This is on summary judgment.
Correct.
They have adduced some evidence that shows there's a disputed issue of material fact here. I don't understand the judge's order. He keeps referring to allegations in the complaint, and that's not where this case is.
And I do want to get to that because I was confused a bit, too, when I saw the order. But it comes down to the cases, and we discussed them in our brief. Grimmett is one of them. There are others that basically says, even on summary judgment, in this sort of a situation, when plaintiffs are alleging that the statute of limitations is somehow told, they have to plead and prove their allegations, and that this is properly part of a summary judgment procedure. There are a number of cases that have done it, I assume because it's common in these sorts of situations when statute of limitations is raised on a motion for summary judgment that the opposition raises this issue.
So the district court found that it was not sufficiently pled. The allegations in the complaint are not sufficient. So the only question before us is he right about that? If the allegations were sufficient, then the judgment has to be reversed.
No. I would say no, because the other prong is it has to be sufficiently pleaded and proved. The court found both.
The court never got to that point.
Oh, it did, because otherwise the court would not have said there is not a shred of evidence, that's the court's words in the order, to support these allegations. So the court did reach that issue, Your Honor. It was an alternative grounds. Judge Wright said you didn't plead it, you didn't prove it. And it's right in his order.
He doesn't make it that clear that he's saying that. You know that. I've read that paragraph a few times myself.
I'm sorry. That's how I read it. I'm not trying to be cute here, Your Honor. That's how I read it.
Of course you're going to read it the way that it's most favorable to your
– I'm an advocate. I suppose I have to do that. No, I'm telling you honestly that's how I read it. I'm not trying to –
Okay. All right.
Well, here's what – I'm not trying to deceive anybody.
The Court said, for the reasons discussed, the Court finds the plaintiffs have not sufficiently pled with particularity the facts that give rise to the fraudulent concealment tolling defense. As such, the statute of limitation has expired.
True.
So this is a pleading case. You may have used the terminology of summary judgment, but the science is insufficient pleading. So we have to consider whether the pleading was sufficient. We don't have any analysis of the evidence presented in summary judgment.
Wait, I'm sorry. I understood you right up until the end, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
We have no analysis by the Court as to whether the evidence was sufficient. The foundation for the Court's ruling is that there was insufficient pleading. So that's what we have to look at. And what's your position on that?
My position is that it's not sufficiently pleaded and that it's not sufficiently proven. And this Court can affirm on either ground. That's what my client's position is, that there is insufficient evidence of concealment. What there is evidence of is that there are certain things in the report that they claim are not true. That's true, and we live with that allegation. That's fine. That's not the same as concealment. That's not the same as preventing someone from discovering they have a cause of action.
But if you look at the complaint, there are about 18 paragraphs reciting instances of concealment. Now, you say that's not sufficient pleading?
I do say that. I say that that is not sufficient because the city did nothing to prevent plaintiffs from discovering they had a cause of action. I understand what their allegations are. They said, well, you didn't include this in the report. You didn't include that. And they conclude, well, you concealed those facts. I understand that that's what the allegations are. But what Judge Wright saw missing was active effort by the city to make sure these plaintiffs never knew what was going on. And that's not what happened. And certainly that's not what happened when you have a police report in your possession that references a surveillance video. How can there be concealment on those facts or on that pleading? How that's our position. You can't have fraudulent concealment on those facts as a matter of law.
But they allege everything that would satisfy under a notice pleading standard, which is what we have, a fraudulent concealment claim. This is notice pleading in federal court.
And I understand.
They don't have to plead every single fact.
And the only thing we decide now is whether the grant of summary judgment on this record was proper.
Obviously, sure.
And if we say no, you haven't said who wins or who loses.
I understand.
You've got to go ahead
and battle that out at trial. I certainly understand that. And again, I apologize. I guess I see.
Well, maybe I should apologize, but I think you were taking us beyond that point. I think you were taking us to look at, I don't know, whatever proof there is on either side to say.
That's because that's because I honestly read Judge Wright's order as in the alternative. And if the court disagrees, then the court disagrees, and we can't look at that. If the holding is no, it's strictly a pleading case, and we look at the allegations and then we're done, even though it came up on summary judgment, then I understand. My position is I don't read Judge Wright's order that narrowly. There is a discussion of the evidence, and I don't believe there is evidence of fraudulent concealment on this record. And that makes the affirmance of summary judgment proper. But I think the court understands my point. And that's fine. So unless the court has further questions, I will submit.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay. Gomez versus Torrens is submitted. Jameson versus Astru has been removed from the calendar, as has Jimenez versus Franklin.